Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. The first confirmed North Texas patient with Ebola is under medical quarantine at Texas Health Presbyterian Hospital in Dallas. Staff members say the man fell ill 4 days after he arrived in Texas from Liberia. He was admitted into the hospital's isolation ward this past Sunday, 2 days before lab results confirmed that he was indeed infected with the deadly Ebola virus. This just in, several school children were apparently exposed to the Ebola patient. They are home under observation now, medical observation. On his first trip to the ER, the patient told the nurse that saw him that he was from Liberia, but she did not reportedly pass it up the chain at the hospital. This is from a report from the Associated Press. Ebola has sickened more than 6,500 people in several West African countries this year and killed about 3,100. Many medical centers, including those in North Texas, have been preparing for the possibility that isolated cases of the disease might turn up in other parts of the world. And U.S. authorities are stressing that while Ebola is indeed a very serious infection, modern American health systems are well equipped to care for patients and limit the spread of the disease in this country. Dr. Robert Haley joins us to talk more about this. He is professor of internal medicine and director of the Department of Epidemiology and Internal Medicine at UT Southwestern Medical Center. Earlier in his career, he spent 10 years working at the U.S. Centers for Disease Control. Dr. Haley, welcome back to Think.
Glad to be here, Chris. Mm-hmm.
So we don't have specific details on the condition of this patient. Based on the fact that we know he's in about the eighth day of his illness, what might we assume about the symptoms he could be experiencing?
Well, I think he's listed as critically ill, and that's what you would expect anybody with Ebola at this point. Fortunately for him, he's in a U.S. hospital. Maybe not so fortunate for the hospital, but I'm sure they're straining and really working hard on this. But in this country, the mortality rate would be much lower than you would see in an African country, particularly West African country, because we, in our modern hospitals, we can offer really aggressive fluid resuscitation, intravenous fluids and electrolyte management and other supportive care. And that's really the key to survival in these patients. So, for example, recently in Nigeria, a single patient from Liberia flew to Nigeria on a flight while he was ill and exposed 70 or so people on the way and when he got there. And out of that, about 18 or 19 more people got Ebola. But Nigeria has a pretty good healthcare system, unlike those other West African countries. And the mortality rate there, they saved 60% of them, whereas normally you would expect about half that many to survive. And so that just shows that what a dramatic effect on mortality that good supportive care in a modern hospital can do. Whereas in West Africa and Liberia and Sierra Leone and Guinea, their hospital systems are very primitive. They don't have the equipment or the know-how. And so the people are basically untreated and live or die based on their constitution.
The patient was actually admitted to the hospital 2 days after he initially visited the emergency room. Let's listen here as Dr. Edward Goodman, the top infectious disease specialist at Presbyterian in Dallas, explains why the patient was released the first time he came in.
I think he was evaluated for his illness, which was very nondescript. He had some laboratory tests, which were not very impressive, and he was dismissed on some antibiotic because he was like the majority of people who come in the emergency room.
You can't always tell, Dr. Robert Haley, what is wrong with someone who feels lousy when they walk in the emergency room.
Oh, absolutely. And think about our modern emergency rooms where we have not yet extended Obamacare to our unfunded patients, to the Medicaid patients. Our emergency rooms are just filled to the brim. And so our emergency room staffs are greatly overburdened. They have a huge caseload. So, I mean, they're like drinking out of a fire hose, you know. It's very difficult. And there will be a temptation to judge that diagnosis on standards from this week on.
Based on what we know now.
Based on what we know now. Whereas before, when that patient came in, remember, we had not seen a case in this country. and it was not clear that we ever would. In fact, it's the first case outside of West Africa. And so that it was not on the radar screen, really. I thought that was probably very appropriate care, and there's probably nothing more we could have done. It was just he looked like, a thousand other ER patients that were coming through. Now that we've had one, this is going to change dramatically, and you will see all the emergency rooms. In fact, the alert's already gone out to all the emergency rooms in the city, certainly, and I'm sure all over the country, that those type of nondescript illnesses, we need to start making at least asking the question, have you traveled in the last 3 weeks? And anybody who's traveled from West Africa obviously would be treated differently now.
Why does it take so long, or at least a matter of a day or two, to confirm the Ebola virus is what's making a patient sick?
Yeah. when a person develops the illness, the virus replicates in their body, and there's a sequence to the events. The first, for some period of time, several days up to 3 weeks, they can be asymptomatic, and the virus is just getting a foothold. At that point, they're not infectious to others. When it begins affecting them, they break out with a sudden fever, fairly high fever, headache, maybe a skin rash. But of course, that's a fairly common thing we see in the emergency room among these thousands of people parading by. And then usually a day or two later, maybe 3 days later, then they become much more ill all of a sudden, and they start vomiting, maybe having diarrhea. And then that goes on for several days, and then it attacks the liver and or the kidneys, and then they really start crashing. And if that happens, then they're very likely to die, although supportive care even at that point can save some of them. Many don't go to that stage. Many will get the vomiting and so forth, and with good supportive care, if they can be put through that, supported through that, then they'll just get well on their own. But during that phase, it takes a while for the virus to replicate enough to have enough in the bloodstream to detect it with the test. And that's why you see a delay in the ability to detect it. But by the time they start vomiting, the test is typically positive.
We have heard that patients are not contagious who have Ebola until they start showing symptoms. We should note that CDC Director Dr. Tom Friedan says patients flying from Liberia to the U.S. With this particular patient were not exposed to the disease and are not at any elevated risk whatsoever.
Yeah, this is really the most important point for the public to understand. Ebola is transmitted by the body fluids of a person who's desperately sick. So it's not transmitted through the air or by touching or casual contact or conversation or being in the same room with somebody who is well, who doesn't feel bad. In fact, it's probably true, although this is not totally clear, but it's probably true that they're not even infectious when they get fever. It's probably when they start vomiting or bleeding or having diarrhea, so that their body fluids, which are heavily infected, are actually cast about over their body or in the environment, and then people can become exposed to those. And typically what happens is if a healthcare worker or a family member or a mourner at a funeral, typically in West Africa, these are the people who get it, they would get some of that body fluid on their hands and then rub their eyes or rub their nose or somehow get it in their mouth. Or maybe in a cut on a finger or something. That's how you would get it. And so unless you've had contact like that with a very sick person who just came from West Africa, you have no chance of getting this disease. So this is not going to spread through the community. You're not going to get it by people you don't know coming into your coffee room or whatever, or to a restaurant. It's not going to spread that way. And the reason we know that is, we've known about this virus since 1976, and there have been many outbreaks in Central Africa and in East Africa, and now in West Africa, and all of these follow the same pattern. The people who get sick are close family members who've had a lot of physical contact with the body fluids of these people, or mourners at funerals who embrace the body or kiss the body or handle the body or wash the body for preparation for the funeral, or healthcare workers who are caring for this body that's soiled in bodily fluids, blood, urine, diarrhea, or vomitus. And so if, except for those, we don't see people getting sick.
Yesterday, the press conference at Texas Health Presbyterian mentioned the use of what were called contact isolation and droplet precautions to prevent the spread of infection within the hospital. Can you explain what that means exactly?
Yeah, there is a very well-developed, frequently revised set of isolation precautions that all hospitals in this country and in the Western world and throughout the country, throughout the world, have used. It was developed at the CDC back in the late 60s, early 70s. In fact, when I was there, I was involved in developing that and revising it several times. And this has various categories of precautions based on the way a particular disease is transmitted. So, for example, tuberculosis is transmitted by coughing, and it goes through the air. That's very dangerous. And so you have what's called airborne precautions, where you have a private room with airflow control and everybody wears a tight-fitting, high-filtration mask. Well, Ebola isn't transmitted that way, so you don't need that. For Ebola, there are three categories of precautions that would apply. Standard precautions, which means you just take a standard set of things you do with everybody, that if you're going to be in contact with secretions, you wear gloves, okay? And there are certain routine precautions. But then droplet precautions, which means if you're going to be in the room within 3 to 4 feet of the patient, you should wear wear a mask so that you don't breathe in the droplets that can sneeze or cough that might go 3 or 4 feet. Okay, and then also there is contact precautions, so that if you touch the patient, you need to be wearing gloves, you need to be wearing a gown, booties, and perhaps a facial shield and so forth to prevent you to being exposed to their bodily fluids by contact. So all hospital people know these, and we use them constantly because there are many diseases that use these various types of precautions. So this is a routine in all hospitals, and we have an infection control physician and an infection control practitioner, a nurse or a similar person who take training courses in infection control, and they go about producing guidelines and policies for how things are to be managed throughout the hospital. And they constantly monitor that to be sure everybody's doing it right. And they hold in-service training classes for all the personnel and require that people do it. And because of that, that's why we're confident that when this comes into a hospital in the United States, it's not going to spread, and there will be minimal risk to our hospital employees because they are doing these fire drills, which they've been practicing and implementing for literally decades.
And in fact, most hospitals in the U.S. would have the ability to have sort of full isolation for a patient with any kind of infectious disease?
Yes. Yeah. It's a highly developed system. It's required by the Joint Commission on Accreditation of Healthcare Organizations that accredits hospitals, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid that accredit for them for Medicare patients. All of these things are required by these organizations that accredit hospitals.
We're speaking this hour with Dr. Robert Haley, professor of internal medicine and director of the Department of Epidemiology and Internal Medicine at UT Southwestern Medical Center. He spent 10 years working at the U.S. Centers for Disease Control. We're talking about the confirmed Ebola case in North Texas, specifically in Dallas. If you'd like to join the conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering a new certificate program in project management November 3rd through 7th on the SMU campus. Information at smu.edu/project-management.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Dr. Robert Haley, professor of internal medicine and director of the Department of Epidemiology and Internal Medicine at UT Southwestern Medical Center. We're talking about the confirmed Ebola case in Dallas. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. Tell us, Dr. Haley, about the differences between the kind of hospital that this patient is in at Texas Health Presbyterian and the kind of hospital he might have encountered had he become sick, not having left Liberia and walked to a local hospital there or walked into a local hospital there.
Well, it's night and day. And here in this country, you've got a highly organized healthcare system where hospitals are generally well-staffed. And in this particular hospital, the infection control program, very organized, is led by Dr. Ed Goodman, who is one of the deans of infection control in the country. He's been working in this since the 1970s, and so very experienced. They even had held a drill on Ebola a week before this all started. So, I mean, everybody in the hospital was geared up, ready to meet this. So, I mean, now contrast that to a primitive hospital in Liberia or Sierra Leone, which is understaffed. They don't have enough doctors or nurses to run it. It's overcrowded with people with malaria and all kinds of other diseases that look just like this. They have no technological ability to deliver technological care. They don't have enough IV fluids to treat these people. They can't run lab tests to check their blood composition to tune the IV fluids. And the doctors and nurses don't have gloves, disposable gloves. They don't have gowns and isolation equipment to protect themselves from the Ebola threat. So, if you get Ebola in West Africa, basically your ability to survive is just your own constitution, because the treatment, there's just no treatment. You die untreated. Whereas in this country, our hospitals are fully equipped, and this is a challenge for the doctors and nurses to try to pull all of these people through. We will do a lot better. So it's night and day.
We are lucky enough in this country to have a really robust medical system. We have lots of equipment. We have people studying these things and looking for best practices. On the other hand, it is a fairly regular thing that we'll hear about an outbreak of some kind of opportunistic infection that happens within a hospital setting. People who came in for something get very sick and sometimes even die from something entirely different that they picked up in the hospital. So can you give us some perspective on why that is unlikely to happen with this Ebola infection?
You mean why Ebola won't be transmitted in the hospital?
In the same way that things like MRSA and other things have been.
Well, these days, hospital-acquired infections are primarily complications of high-tech medicine. That is, the things we do to patients, which are a blessing, which dramatically improve survival and reduce morbidity and mortality. For example, transplants and immunosuppressive therapy for immunologic diseases and steroid therapy, which greatly reduces symptoms for many diseases. All of these treatments, renal dialysis, kidney dialysis, for example, is a good one, heart transplants. These are life-saving technology that save huge numbers of lives. But that comes at a small increase in risk for infection, because when you do these things to patients, you also make them a little more susceptible to very unusual infections. But you got to remember the balance. You save large numbers of lives, and a small number of people will develop an infection, which could even be fatal. Mm-hmm. But the balance is really in favor of strongly in favor of benefit. Now, Ebola is completely different. Ebola is something that probably anybody who's exposed to the bodily fluids of a person who has Ebola, who's sick with Ebola, probably anybody who's exposed to that virus will get it. Now, I'm not sure of that. There may be people with natural immunity. We don't know that. But right now we're assuming that anybody who would be exposed to bodily fluids from a sick person would probably get this. So it's a fairly highly infectious thing, unlike the types of infections we see in regular hospitalized patients that result from the treatment. Though the germ that they get in those infections is typically something that wouldn't hurt you or me who are outside the hospital not undergoing those complex therapies. Those are called opportunistic organisms because they can only affect you when there's an unusual opportunity that lets them in. Okay, whereas Ebola can infect somebody, anybody who's exposed to the bodily fluids.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go on the line to Beth in Fort Worth. Hi, Beth.
Hi. Today, Lori Garrett, a journalist who does some reporting on global epidemics, said on NPR that ERs in America were doing recent travel intake inquiries. And on the news just now, it sounded like an intake inquiry had been done at Presbyterian when the man first came to the ER, but that the information wasn't forwarded to any other team members. And as a layman, I find it kind of stunning that an ill, feverish recent arrival from Liberia wasn't put in an observational status. My question is, do you know if travel inquiries were done at Presbyterian, if they're done at other hospitals, if it's required by the CDC, or if it's just up to each state or each hospital, or if a travel inquiry is even relevant?
I have no idea of I don't know anything about the circumstances in that event. But again, let me caution that right now there's a strong tendency to judge that event by the way we're thinking this week. Last week and before, nobody was thinking about this. Now, you know, maybe we should, maybe we shouldn't, but also remember in Texas, we have not done anything about our uninsured population. We have thousands of people who are uninsured streaming into our emergency rooms, increasing our tax base, our tax rates. You know, this is a really difficult situation for our emergency departments. They are inundated and they're understaffed. They can't keep enough staff in there. So they're doing the best they can to take care of a huge burden that our society, our state is not handling. So when you judge that, the world has changed this week. And Texas has really burdened these ER people unfairly. So I think we need to keep that in mind.
Let me ask you this, and I think you've done a good job communicating just how well-trained the staffs at most hospitals and emergency rooms are to deal with situations like this. Given the symptoms that we're told that this patient had initially, a fever, a headache, I might walk into PrimaCare with those symptoms.
Absolutely. And there would be hundreds of people like you before and right after you, and there would be a long line.
But would the folks at PrimaCare know to ask about travel history, and would they be able to take instant measures to sort of isolate a patient who might have symptoms of something like Ebola?
I guarantee you they will this week and from here on. Now, last week, I doubt it.
Travel restrictions, are they appropriate? Should we look more closely at people coming into the U.S. from affected countries?
Well, I do know that this particular person who is now in Presbyterian Hospital was screened at the airport in Liberia. He was screened for temperature and had no fever and was not sick and was allowed to come on the plane appropriately. But it just shows you there's a 21-day incubation period from the time you're exposed till the last day you could possibly develop the illness. Now, most of them occur within 8 or 10 days, but still within 21 days. So you can imagine if somebody is feeling very good, has no fever, gets on a plane, they could come here, and as this person could be walking around in Dallas with no fever and feeling fine for a week or so before they became ill. So there's no practical way to prevent that other than shutting off traffic and air traffic, and we definitely don't want to do that. You know, right now, the West African countries are bitterly complaining of there has been some compromise in the number of flights and so forth, and that's having a big negative impact on their economies, just at a time when their economies are in trouble. And so that's just when you don't want to cut off air travel because of its huge disruptive effect. So, you know, right now, this is such a rare event. This is the first one that's occurred outside of Africa, anywhere in the world. And so, you know, with one case, we don't want to panic and do something that would be destructive. So I think right now we're doing fine. Screening at those airports is a prudent thing to do. And mainly at the other end of the flights, we need to be aware and be now realize that it is possible. We are going to see these cases, and so we need our ERs need to be in private doctors and primary care clinics and whatever need to really be aware of travel history and start implementing it.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Margaret in Dallas. Hello, Margaret.
Hello. How are you?
Very well. Thank you.
I'm going back to an earlier part of the conversation, and it's about the airline passenger who had Ebola and then exposed it to other passengers on the airline. I'm curious how that infection spread. And then I want to tie that also to public transportation.
Okay, this particular person who's in the hospital in Dallas here was not ill during that flight, and so there's no likelihood that anybody on that flight was exposed and will become ill. And now I suspect that those people are being notified by the CDC. CDC investigators are on site here now, and that's really going to be extremely helpful. But nobody expects any of them to become ill, nor anybody that this person was in contact with the first few days he was here before he became ill. So now there's a very interesting example. There was a person who actually a Liberian American who flew from Liberia to Nigeria. I mentioned this a minute ago, but and he was desperately ill before he left, and he had to pull some strings with some people he knew to get on the plane ill. And he flew to Nigeria and exposed some people there, but nobody on the plane that he was with, even though he was vomiting on the plane, nobody on the plane has become ill in 21 days. So even though he was vomiting, and he was a great risk, nobody on the plane got sick. So the risk to in public transportation is probably close to zero unless somebody's, really vomiting and moving around and getting bodily fluids on people, which, would be a very, very unlikely thing to happen. So I don't think public transportation or movie theaters or, places where people go publicly, you just don't see people walking around vomiting and bleeding and having diarrhea openly, in these settings. I mean, so I don't think that's not where the risk is. In this country, the risk is to the family members, and they're at real risk. And there's a slight risk to the hospital workers if they break accepted technique. Okay. So I think that's where all the risk is. And I don't think we need to look at other places because it just isn't a, we got plenty of things to do. We don't have to look where it's not a problem.
And plenty to worry about without adding worry.
Exactly. We've got plenty of things on our plate.
How do hospital workers go through the process of disinfecting, decontaminating, whatever they've been wearing to protect them after spending time in a room with a patient who has Ebola?
Yeah. Well, when you come out of the isolation room, you pull off your gown and pull it over your gloves and take them all off in one motion and put them in the disposal area. And then you go wash your hands. So that's critical that you follow those steps so that you don't contaminate your hands with the outside of your gloves. I mean,
and this is something that
elementary.
People are trained to do.
Oh, absolutely. We have, as I mentioned, our infection control. Every hospital has an infection control program. It's mandated. And these are typically, and certainly in Dallas and Fort Worth, these are hospital infection control programs are really good, and particularly at Presbyterian's, one of the leaders. And so they give in-service. They train the nurses and they train the doctors, and they monitor these. They walk around and they observe what people are doing and make sure they're doing it right. So, and this is regardless of irrespective of Ebola. This has been going on for decades.
So we have one confirmed case of Ebola in this country, not counting those that were transferred here after they became ill overseas. And we have the CDC flying in, and we have these coordinated efforts. I can't help but wonder if the first reported cases of Ebola in urban West Africa had been treated with a similar response, if we might have quelled this raging infection there that doesn't look like it's going to be under control for some number of months now.
There's absolutely no doubt that that's exactly what would have happened had this been addressed in West Africa the way it was addressed here and the way it was addressed in Nigeria. Remember that patient that person I mentioned who flew from Liberia to Nigeria, got off the plane? He initially exposed people who helped him from the airplane to the cab, became ill. And then some workers in the hospitals became ill. And then it was stopped. Then immediately an army of public health workers got into the act, went and traced everybody on that plane, all the people who had contact, all the hospital workers, everybody who had contact with that person. They traced them, put them under a quarantine for 21 days. And at that point, it's called under control. And after twice 21 days, 42 days, it's considered the outbreak's over. And that's exactly what happened. And the outbreak's over in Nigeria unless they import another case. But had that been done in West Africa, we would not be seeing what was this massive, horrible epidemic that unprecedented Ebola epidemic would not have occurred.
Who has legal authority to tell an exposed patient that they have to remain in quarantine?
This is the authority of the county health officer. By state law, the county health officer, the head of our Dallas – the physician in our Dallas County Health and Human Services has the legal authority to impose this. Now, for most people, you don't need an authority. You just tell them, you know, look, your life is in danger. We want to watch you and work with you. And if you start getting sick, let us know immediately and we'll get you to a hospital and make sure that you're taken care of and make sure that your loved ones are taken care of. And when they tell that to people, 99% of people are going to say, yes, please help me. and it works fine. And by the way, let me just say that we are lucky to have our Dallas County Health Department, our State Health Department, CDC, working with our hospitals, because this partnership is what really makes all this work.
My guest is Dr. Robert Haley, Professor of Internal Medicine and Director of the Department of Epidemiology and Internal Medicine at UT Southwestern Medical Center. He spent 10 years working at the U.S. Centers for Disease Control. We're talking about the confirmed Ebola case in Dallas. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering a new certificate program in project management November 3rd through 7th on the SMU campus. Information at smu.edu/project management.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking this hour about the confirmed case of Ebola at a hospital in Dallas with Dr. Robert Haley, Professor of Internal Medicine and Director of the Department of Epidemiology and Internal Medicine at UT Southwestern Medical Center. You can join us by emailing think@kera.org. And we have what producer Stephen Becker calls a lightning round of questions culled from email here. Margaret in Garland wants to know, Dr. Haley, are hospital workers who dealt with the patient the first time he was in the ER at risk?
Oh, good question. And the answer is almost certainly no, because he just had a headache and, you know, viral type, you know, flu-like symptoms. He was not vomiting or having diarrhea. And that's my understanding. If that's the case, there were no bodily fluids being cast about. And so they were probably not at risk. And also... Presumably, they were following what we call standard precautions, which should interrupt this in most cases anyway.
Jay in Dallas wants to know, can Ebola be transmitted through the bodily fluids of infected animals?
Good question. Yes, and I believe that's the case. It's typically, in fact, the index case, the first case in the West African epidemic was a woman who was vending what's called bush meat. That means going out in the bush and slaughtering whatever you can find. And she slaughtered a fruit bat, which is thought to be the reservoir of this virus out in the wilds, and either consumed it or was infected in the process of slaughtering this fruit bat. And that was apparently the index case. Now, whether it's from the it most likely would be from the blood of these, but I don't know. I'm not a veterinarian, so I don't know the ins and outs of that.
And we should always stay away from downed bats anyway.
Yes,
in any
absolutely.
Situation. Michael wants to know
we ought to add, though, Ebola is not in the wilds here in America, so there are no infected bats or any other animals in in the Americas at all. It's only in Africa.
In the U.S., the concern would be rabies from bats.
Yes, right. Mm-hmm.
Michael wants to know how long the virus can survive on something like a doorknob or a handrail.
Good question. We don't know. I don't think that study's been done, but it couldn't. It's not important in transmission of it. And the reason we know from the epidemiology of it, the pattern of the infections, we don't see it. Infecting in Africa and all the outbreaks they've seen in Africa, we don't see it in people who are just in the neighborhood and, you know, happen to go in a door that an Ebola patient came out of, which would mean people would be getting it randomly all over the place. We don't see that. In Africa, it's very typically just the immediate family members, the intimate contacts, and the people who were at the funeral, you know, who were touching the victim and the healthcare workers. So if that's the case, it's not being transmitted by doorknobs. It's being transmitted by directly touching the bodily fluids of that very sick, critically ill person.
Several questions about mutations. One from John in Fort Worth. We have another question from Christine. John writes, I've heard that high levels of transmission can enable rapid mutations in the virus. Could Ebola mutate to be spread through other means than direct contact with infected bodily fluids?
Yes, that is a concern. And Ebola is like HIV and influenza. It's an RNA virus instead of a DNA virus. And RNA viruses are much more primitive. DNA viruses have a checking mechanism that when they replicate and produce little baby viruses or whatever, if there's a gene mutation, that replication is destroyed, so they don't mutate much. Whereas RNA viruses lack that checking mechanism, and so they mutate wildly. And so you get all kinds of crazy mutations, most of which aren't compatible with life, so they just die out. But occasionally you'll get one that is. And so there's a great danger that these things will mutate to some different form. And every person who gets an Ebola infection produces several trillion replications of that virus before the person dies, okay? And so several trillion opportunities for a mutation to emerge. So far, the epidemics we've had have not been enough replications to produce a real Andromeda strain type Ebola that could spread through the air, which would be a wholesale disaster, a worldwide disaster. That hasn't happened. But when you have a much larger epidemic like we're seeing in West Africa, which is 10 to 100 times larger than the epidemics we saw in East Africa, now you're getting into the thousands of trillions of replications. And the more you do, the more chance you have of selecting out that Andromeda strain. So this is, besides the human toll, the catastrophe of human toll, the disorganization of their society, there's also this risk of producing a terrible strain by mutation. So it's another reason we should be very involved in West Africa, trying to control this out of self-interest as well as humanitarian motivations.
How prepared would our top-notch healthcare system be in the event of a mutation that made Ebola airborne?
If Ebola were airborne, the only salvation would be in an immunization, like we do with flu.
Mm-hmm.
You know, influenza without flu vaccine, it just goes right through the population. You can't stop it. And fortunately, flu kills only about 40,000 people a year.
But we don't have an Ebola vaccine.
Yes, there are a couple of vaccines, at least, that have been under development for 10 years. The problem is they couldn't test them. You see, you can only test it in a large epidemic, and there haven't been any large epidemics.
Until now.
Until now. And they are now testing the vaccines in West Africa, and they're starting to test treatments for people who've already infected. And they're actually using this opportunity, this large epidemic, to try to test these and see if we can prove whether they work or not.
And we heard that ZMapp, the experimental drug that was being used for the patients that were cared for in Atlanta, I believe, that there's no more. What is this stuff and why can't we make more?
Well, of course, this epidemic came out of the blue. Mm-hmm. And the companies that were developing these treatments were, as my understanding, they were sort of at a stop because, you know, there were no more epidemics going on at the time. And there wasn't much market for this because the epidemics were small in Africa, and so there weren't an opportunity to really get them there. And so, but then, of course, when this thing started spiraling out of control in West Africa, suddenly everybody got more interested. The NIH jumped on it and started encouraging these companies and the Defense Department as well. So there's suddenly a lot of interest and a lot of government, very good federal government help trying to target these and facilitate getting them into testing and so forth. So this is again, you got to see this as a partnership between our hospitals, our local county health departments, our state health departments, the CDC, the NIH, and the World Health Organization. All of these, and then nonprofits like Doctors Without Borders and so forth. All these players are collaborating, and this is really kind of one of our finest hours in public health, to see this apparatus working so efficiently and protecting us all from these horrible things.
Sounds like, though, that we can't rely strictly on market-driven solutions, because there is no money in an Ebola drug, but you need public and nonprofit dollars to support this kind of research?
Yeah. Only our federal government can really coordinate all this and really get all this working. You know, there's a very important role for government here, because the private sector absolutely could not. You know, you can't make a profit doing this. So it's got to be our government, and they're really doing a good job.
Email here from Casey, who says, "What happens to bodily fluids from an infected patient in isolation? Are they treated before they get to, say, local wastewater treatment plants?"
It's a very good question. In the sewage disposal system and so forth, one of the great things about it is there's a dilutional factor. It's the same thing if, you know, this same question was asked, if could terrorists go out and pour poison in one of our lakes that we get our drinking water from and poison the whole city? And the great savior there is the dilutional factor. You know, as you dilute these things out, they become, you know, one little virus particle all by itself. Also, then they tend to die out fairly quickly in that environment. And so again, if that were a problem, if that were really infecting people, the epidemiology would be entirely different. You would see people, you know, down the chain of, you know, wherever the sewage was going, you would see people all along that line getting infected without any contact with infected people. And we don't see that in Ebola. So it's just not it's not an issue.
Any concern that healthcare workers in this country will be concerned about going to work if they're going home to, say, family members?
If they do, we have really failed in our hospitals. I mean, we train our hospital workers, and they know these issues. And I'm sure there are a lot of meetings going on right now in hospitals to make sure everybody knows. But no, they're very sophisticated. They know how isolation, how infection things work, and I think they're all pretty savvy.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Robin on the line in Dallas. Hello, Robin. Robin, are you with us? Okay, let's move on. Let's talk to Vince in Weatherford. Hi, Vince.
Hi. Quick question. We have many members from West Africa in our communities. our jobs, our churches. What is the advice you would give to overcome any stigma that might develop from this case in Dallas?
Yeah, that's a very good question. You know, this is, we're all humans, and whenever something like this happens, there's a danger that some people will overreact and do something foolish. I think the answer to that is just information. You know, we need to get the information out to the public. That's what this radio show's about. Our newspapers are doing, by the way, the Dallas Morning News has done a great job of covering this thing. Information there has been very accurate and very helpful. So people need to, well, for one thing, people need to read newspapers.
That's a whole other show.
That's
but
a whole
I
other show.
You.
But, you know, there's a lot of information. And I think knowledge is what prevents us from doing silly, hurtful things. I think it, I know there's been a lot of concern about people who are worried that somebody in their organization will come in with Ebola or will develop Ebola from a home situation or something. And the advice there is, look, if you get a headache and fever and start feeling bad, you ought to consult your doctor, you know. But that's always been true. So I'm not sure there's a magic pill for that other than information.
What sort of contact do you imagine that hospital officials here have had with those in other parts of the country that have dealt with cases of Ebola where the patients were brought here to convalesce?
You mean the three other patients?
Yes.
Who brought to Emory and
didn't come
Georgetown.
Down with the illness here, but yes.
Right. Actually, I don't think those were as instructive to our frontline hospitals like Presbyterian that's dealing with that right now, because those were sort of artificial settings where the people got sick over there and they were being taken care of over there. And then they were moved here by the government on purpose, you know, for treatment. And so, of course, that was done with great fanfare, extreme planning. So the patients themselves were put in these bunny suits, you know, isolation suits, and put on a special plane in an isolation tent, you know, on the plane, and then they were carefully moved in an ambulance. So, I mean, that's really unlike seeing a real person with an unknown illness coming into an emergency department. That's a real different thing. And the preparation for that is what we do constantly, is we train our ER staff and we train our hospital employees. And now that we see this is a real possibility, you know, if you go to the emergency room with a headache and fever, I'll bet you're going to be asked where you've traveled in the last 21 days.
And am I correct, Dr. Haley, that you wouldn't hesitate tomorrow to walk into the emergency room at Presbyterian with a sprained ankle? You wouldn't hesitate to go to a doctor who has her offices above the hospital?
Absolutely wouldn't hesitate at all. I would without hesitation go to one of the infectious disease doctors who's making rounds on this infected person, because one, they're not sick. Two, they're smart. They're going to protect themselves. And this is America. It's not going to happen here.
Dr. Robert Haley is professor of internal medicine and director of the Department of Epidemiology and Internal Medicine at UT Southwestern Medical Center. Dr. Haley, thank you again so much for being with
pleasure.
Us.
My pleasure.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.